The Women of Ill Repute, with your hosts, Wendy Mesley and Maureen Holloway.
Well, you know, I may not know a lot about wine, but I do know what I like.
So what do you like?
Wine.
Yeah, well, simple. Me too. Orange wine, red wine, white wine. I like everything. Maybe too much. Or there's that study. According to that study,
No, I don't want to hear about that study. But I will admit to spending a significant portion of my grocery dollar on wine.
So fess up then. How much do you?
How much do I drink?
Yeah.
I mean, no. I'd rather tell you how much I make or how often I have sex, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Not enough.
It's a running theme.
So anyway, our guest this week, she actually knows a lot about wine, the wine industry, sort of a fair amount about journalism, a lot about marketing, and particularly how it targets women.
We're talking to Natalie McLean, who's author of a highly successful newsletter, as well as several books about wine, including a brand new one called Wine Witch on Fire. And although it seems that she has a dream job, she had a terrible experience within the industry that kind of mirrors what happened to you, Wendy, when you left the CBC. We're going to go there.
Yeah.
We're going to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, we are. There's a
just a little.
We are going to talk about my time at the CBC, but mostly we're going to talk about how sexism is in the wine industry, what a wine taster actually does, and how much is too much.
And while we have her, we're going to get some tips, I hope, like what to look for in a less expensive wine or what wine goes with artichokes.
With artichokes?
Yeah, that's a tough pair.
You really eat that many artichokes? Like, really?
I like artichokes. All right. With no further ado, Natalie McLean, thank you for putting up with that intro. It was really nice to see you out in your field there.
It's great to be here, Wendy and Mo. I think we could have this conversation over a glass or two. You seem like my people, my wine people.
We have, honestly, Wendy and I have a lot of conversations over a glass or three, but not usually while we're doing the podcast. But I mean, we could start at any time.
Yeah. So in the background, there's this vineyard or something. So are you, you're like obviously outstanding in your field. You're where are you?
I'm a field reporter. Yeah, that's a painting from California. And I did get permission from the artist to use it as my backdrop. Yes, I've learned a lot in the last 10 years.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, it's the old Inglenook Winery. It's now the Francis Ford Coppola, where you can go see all the movie memorabilia and that sort of thing in his winery.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
I want to get this out of the way because I must admit, like, I knew you were a wine reviewer and I sort of knew about that, but I didn't know until I read the book about how, yeah, I mean, the book is about, it's about drinking, it's about divorce, but it's also about defamation. That's in the title.
Oh, the three D's. Yeah.
Yeah, all the dismal D's. The publishing team said you cannot have delirium, destitution.
Or diarrhea.
Yeah, that's all a lot of books. So anyway, okay. I was kind of struck by the parallels. And then I thought, you know, let's just ignore this because I hate bringing my story about what happened at the CBC and so on onto the podcast. But there's so is it okay if we talk about that? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So, I mean, your thing was not to go deeply into the weeds. Your thing was basically, it was, you quoted a bunch of other people's reviews and you didn't properly cite their, you know, their references and their backgrounds and so on and so forth. Mine was a lot more complicated. I used the N-word. I should never have used the N-word. I used the whole word, but it was with a bunch of colleagues and we were...
It was not used in a derogatory term. You were, this is important to point out, you were actually quoting the title of another piece that you guys wanted to explore. So
yeah, well, we were, George Floyd had just been killed and by the police, and it was a very emotional time. And I hurt people. I should not have used that word. And I apologized immediately. We can get into that because you sort of apologize without apologizing. So it blew up and I sort of expected that the CBC would come to my defense after punishing me, which they should have. Anyway, your situation, that like the whole thing like blew up.
I got completely trashed.
You got completely trashed, but you handled things differently. First of all, you actually had a lawyer, which I never had. And the lawyer told you, whatever you do, do not apologize. So I just, how did you figure out how to get out of that hole?
Sure. So sorry is the most expensive word in the English language because it admits guilt and it can be used litigiously against you. I didn't go to journalism school, and this isn't excuse number one, but I just was so naive. This was back in 2012, kind of the heyday of aggregators, so Huffington Post and Rotten Tomatoes and so on. And when I started quoting these reviews that were actually on the LCBO, the government liquor store site for Ontario, it was because I had noticed some other sites doing it. Anyway, I'm a glass half full kind of gal. So I thought, I'm not going to ask them to take down my reviews. I'm just going to do it too, because doesn't that provide more context for a wine? Somebody else's opinion in addition to mine. Wrong. So the legal advice I got was that I was within the bounds of fair use. Well, it's called fair dealing in Canada. And it's good if we don't go down the legal rabbit hole, because this will get very tedious, very effective.
We'll never get out.
Yeah. This will be your lowest rated podcast ever. but it didn't matter what the legalities were, or that, you know, I offered to fix them or whatever. It was the accusation ignited literally a bonfire. And then it just spiraled from there to other websites and newspapers around the world, from the South Africa Times to the New York Post. It was crazy, all within the span of like 24, maybe 48 hours. So we didn't talk a lot about cancel culture back in 2012, but I think I can speak from experience what it's like. And even when you try to jump in and do any explaining, you add fuel to the fire. So, you know, whether you explain, it goes wild. Whether you don't explain, then they say, hey, she's like not answering the accusations.
I found that so interesting, because you chose to fight back. So you gave interviews and you told people that you had made a mistake and that you were going to fix it. But you also kind of told people to screw off. Whereas I'd worked at CBC for 40 years, and it took a year of being investigated. And during that time, I just thought, you know, they're going to want me back. I've been here for 40 years. I made a mistake. I hurt people without ever meaning to. But they're going to want me back. They didn't want me back. They were perfectly happy to feed the trolls. And then the trolls take over. And as you say, like in your case, the trolls, they went crazy, including some of your colleagues.
They went crazy. It was unbelievable. I looked at the whole thread of after when all this broke. Then what was the day after Christmas, or it was a week before?
It was just a week before. My nightmare before Christmas. Yep.
Yeah. And it was just the vitriol. And the piling on.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's sort of the false fellowship of hating the same person. People want to be part of something larger. And so they'll find some cause, whether, you know, for good or bad. But there's some sort of beyond herd mentality that takes over online. And I think it's made even worse these days with bots encouraging people to get bolder and bolder, you know, with what I call their keyboard courage. So it is really hard to stop. You can't stop it. The only thing you can hope for is it dies from lack of oxygen, or they find the next person to go after.
Which they do, which it does, and they do.
They always do. And that's how mine ended, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting what it does to friends, too. Like, I had a very, very close friend who, you know, 2 years after the fact said to me, Wendy, I'm really sorry. I should have stood up for you more than I did, because so many people thought, well, nobody's talking about it, because I didn't talk about it for a year. You did. You gave interviews. You were public. And I didn't talk about it. And so people were like, even a journalist at another network in Ottawa told a friend of mine, oh, yeah, well, she called somebody the end. No, I didn't. I would never do. So you're right. I mean, people, trolls, they basically take information and they use it to advance their own agenda, whatever that agenda is, whether it's for good or ill. It's just, anyway, it took you 10 years to write this, and now here you are.
I'm a slow writer.
Why 10 years?
10 years because Well, for 5 years, I couldn't look at the notes. At the time, the lawyer told me, take screenshots, keep your journal entries going. And so I did that almost mechanically. And then I locked it away and I couldn't look at those notes for 5 years because, you know, it's just, I mean, I'm not going to compare. Well, I guess I am in some ways. When someone's in a car accident, they've done studies with MRI brain scans and they will read the script of the accident to them. And the brain lights up in the exact same areas and ways as if they're experiencing the accident. So they're not remembering it, they're reliving it. So for 5 years, I just could not look at those notes. And after 5 years, I thought, well, this story is just keeps ricocheting around in my head. I need to let it out, at least on paper. And so I did as a private exercise for making sense of what had happened. But I had no intention of publishing a book.
I've got a whole stash of notes, screenshots, and they're all, yeah. So
give it time. Yeah.
Oh, I mean, I've got quotes. I've got proof of people saying things that would get them fired for like way worse than what I supposedly did. So it's, yeah. So another 5 years will be done.
Or you let it go. I mean, I've not experienced what you guys have experienced. I've had my own traumas, but nothing quite like that. And there's also an argument for saying, okay, shit happened, but I still, my talent hasn't been taken, my talent, well, whatever our talent is, wasn't taken away. And let's focus on that, which I think you've also done because you have climbed out of that, the ashes of that year. You also underwent a divorce. Like it was just the worst year ever.
It was a bad vintage. It was a really bad vintage, personally and professionally.
A lot of D's.
Yeah, exactly. All the D's. But, you know, like to pick up on both your points, the turnaround in terms of deciding to write about it publicly, I mean, I kept talking with women in the industry because what happened was pre-Me Too, pre-Harvey Weinstein, and the wine industry is so clubby. I mean, there is a real social grapevine where you can get delisted very quickly, ostracized. So after that, those 5 years, and after hearing so many stories, I thought, well, you know, I've heard memoirs say, well, I write my story so other people feel less alone. I thought, well, what does that really mean? If our situations are so different, mine and the readers, how can my story help anybody? And so I had to think about that for a while. Like, what am I doing here? But I think, you know, I make the comparison, like when we're parents, and we all have, I think, children, adults in their 23, 24-ish range. But when they are little, we ask them questions. So are you hungry? Are you sad? You know, because we're trying to give them that vocabulary to express their emotions so that they don't have to always resort to crying and tantrums and just screaming. And I think as adults, we forget that our emotions, feelings get more complex as we age. And, you know, Brené Brown, I love her, Dr. Brené Brown, in her Atlas of the Heart book, she deals with 87 emotions because we've lost or don't have the vocabulary to express ourselves. But when we can express ourselves, when we find the words, I think it unlocks something in us, whether it's peace or relief or whatever. So the stories that I'm getting back from early readers is that they are finding themselves in this book, but through a completely different experience. So, you know, they may not have gone through a divorce, but they've probably felt loneliness or the longing for love. They may not have been, you know, chased down by an angry mob online, but they've probably felt career disappointment or a fear of the future. So what I think a good memoir does is allow you to experience all those emotions, put names to them, articulate them, but that you can go through somebody else's story safely and see how someone can emerge on the other side, you know, stronger, wiser, whatever.
You talk about sexism in the industry. I mean, Maureen and radio face a lot of sexism. We can talk about that in television. Certainly there's a lot, but how bad is it in the wine industry?
It's pretty deep-rooted. I can't avoid all these puns, but sorry, I'll try to find another metaphor if I can, but it's my world. So the wine world is so clubby. It's much less formalized than the restaurant industry. So most wineries in Canada and the US have fewer than 20 employees. Most don't have an HR department, let alone a harassment policy. So And all the mentorships or training is usually one-on-one. So whether you want to become a winemaker or a sommelier or whatever you want to do in the industry, it's usually a one-on-one relationship with someone with a much bigger power differential, which of course lends itself to abuse. Lots of studies have been out there. I mean, 2012, 10 years ago, so must be all better and brighter now. It's not. They did a 2018 study where 89% of women in the hospitality industry, which includes wineries and restaurants, experience some form of sexual harassment. In 2020, the New York Times broke the story of the Court of Master Sommeliers, where there was allegations and 21 women came forward about getting sexually harassed by the Court of Master Sommeliers, which is a really hoity-toity kind of a designation you can get in the wine world. So that's 2020. And I think there are more stories that are going to come out. It's just, it's really hard to talk about it in the wine industry. And that's another reason I'm doing this book, because I figure you can't kill me twice. Maybe I'm wrong. I could be wrong.
It's, and this is sort of a corollary of that. This is how women are treated within the industry. Then they get outside as consumers. That's something that you've been very outspoken about. And I was just saying to Wendy before you joined us that immediately if I see something that's pink and says, like, well, Girls Night Out is probably the most prominent example, or has a rose in the bottom of the bottle, or it's like, stop that. Stop selling me that based on pretty. And it's been insidious, and it's encouraged women to embrace the idea that you're not having fun unless you're getting bombed.
Yeah. Really? You know, and that we as women need a reason to drink. You know, it's girls' night out, or it's a fancy occasion. Oh, yeah, or mom's had an exhausting day, so no one's thanking mom, so the damn mom will thank herself with another glass of wine. You know, and the message on the bottle is that we are, you know, we're either babes or battle axes. So babes, you know, drawn to, you know, stilettos and high heels and red lips and roses. Or we're battle axes. I mean, there's Mad Housewife is a brand and so on. But no, the marketing that I see directed towards men in wine is about sophistication and complexity. And a man has a drink because he wants to. No one, he doesn't have to ask. But yeah, women buy 80% of wine. We're still a household purchasers of everything. We drink 66% of it.
I never thought of, you know, I'm a rah-rah feminist kind of person, but I never thought that my drinking was actually a feminist reaction. Okay.
It's like the Virginia Slim cigarettes of the 1960s, those torches of freedom you can declare.
You've come a long way, baby. Not if you're still calling me baby.
Exactly, exactly. Pour yourself another glass.
But what about the artichokes? That's what Maureen really wants to know.
Well, no, well, we can get into pairings, but like the practical stuff. But I want to ask you before we get into that very specific stuff. So I was fascinated, and it reminded me, I think Elvis Costello or Frank Zappa once said, writing about music is like dancing about architecture. And I thought that applies to writing about wine, which is such a sensual and physical experience, is tough. What do you call them? Not a super taster.
Yes. That doesn't mean I drink a lot, though. I used to.
Tell us about that and how you translate that into writing about it. And then we'll get to the artichokes.
Sure. Super taster is a phenomenon that was discovered in 1999 by Dr. Linda Barastuck. And she tested various people, how dense their taste buds are. And she discovered that the phenomenon of super taster applies to about 25% of the population, most of whom are women. And it just means you have a lot of taste buds. She said they live in a sensory neon world. It's like having 500 fingers instead of five. So,
ew.
I've seen that in the movie, I think.
It gets worse. So it makes you a more sensitive taster. Not necessarily a better taster, that comes with practice. But what goes along with that is a sensitivity to your world. So when I got tested to see if I was one, the person testing me said, I'll bet you take out the tags of all your clothing. And I do. I bet you have.
Oh, I do that. But I'm not a wine reviewer.
Well, no, but you're super sensitive.
Sensitive. Yeah. Like living in a neon world. Have thermostat wars with your family. Like you're just super attuned to every little muscle twitch someone makes or whatever. Tea, not coffee. Very attuned, yes.
Well, that's what we say anyway, very attuned, very attuned. So can you not be a sommelier if you're not a super taster?
Oh, sure, you can be a sommelier, you can be a wine writer and so on. It's not a prerequisite. In fact, some would argue that it's can work against you sometimes because you will come across a very big wine, a full bodied, lots of oak, lots of alcohol. And it's just like, turn it down. It's like the guy who's too loud at the bar. It's like, you don't want to take that one home. But you have to recognize like there's a broad spectrum of palates. And so when I review wines, I'm reviewing it for people who love full bodied wines. You love this wine, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Hey there. Just so you know, Mo and I are not just the queens of podcasting.
I'm not sure we're even that, but do go on.
We're not part-time cowgirls.
We just made that up.
But we are writers. We're writers.
Wendy and I write a newsletter on Substack. It's a weekly roundup of thoughts and experiences, sometimes serious, often not.
Yeah, you're pretty funny. You write about falling down a lot. You write about your dog.
I do. You write about sex and politics and COVID.
All very, very serious things. We have a few thousand subscribers, both free and paid.
And you could be one of them if you'd like. Just go to substack.com and look us up by name or go to our website at womenofillrepute.com and sign up there. We'd love to meet you there.
And now back to being the queens of podcasting.
Yeah, sure.
The Women of Ill Repute.
I was fascinated to hear about the setup that you have. So you've got cases of wine all over your house that people send you, and you try to taste 30 bottles a day. So I have two questions. Is there a lot of spitting? And secondly, what happens to all the open bottles? And do you need any help with that?
Can we come?
I guess that's three questions.
Yeah, recycling day here is just an embarrassment on the street with the crowds fighting.
Well, it is here too, and I'm not... I hide my blue box. But tell me, so you get sent all this stuff. How... And you take notes and you go down the row and you sip all these wines and you clean your palate. Tell me more.
Then what happens?
Well, the difference between tasting and drinking is thinking and spitting. So you do have to expectorate spit or else you will be sloshed. Like the best time to taste in the day is at 9 a.m. And facing 30, you know, full-bodied Cabernets from Chile is not exactly, you know, a lovely thing, although I have no sympathy for my job. But yeah, I will taste usually actually later in the day, compare like to like, line up those bottles. And then what I do, I only take an ounce or two and then spit it out. I recork all the bottles and pass them on to other sommeliers or writers here in the community so that the wineries who are sending me samples will get more than one review, of course, only if we like it.
So we're not invited over, I guess. Maureen.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, sadly, my friends like looked like, oh, is that what you do with them? Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, I guess
so
that's very worthy.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, pairing. You have a knack for pairing, like unparalleled.
It's my superpower. So artichokes, getting to the heart of the matter. So I come from Nova Scotia, so it's all about puns and cannot help myself. Anyway, so artichokes and asparagus both produce a natural organic compound called cinnarin, which tastes very bitter. So what happens is that after you eat artichokes, everything you eat and drink after that is going to taste sweeter by comparison. So that really wreaks havoc on wine, especially if you have maybe even an off dry, just a little bit of sweetness in your wine. It's going to taste really cloying and sweet. So the answer or the recommendation I give is to go with a really bone dry white wine. So it's going to bring up the fruit, make it taste a little sweeter, but not cloying. And, you know, your taste buds will be happy and your artichoke will be tasting better as well.
Good to know. So we've debunked the red with red meat and only white with chicken. That we've broken down those barriers, I guess. But wither rosé.
Oh. Yes, rosé all day. Although I'm supposed to be talking moderation after this book, or
we won't.
Rosé is a beautiful wine. Just love it. Like, so we have to forget the 1970s, 80s sweet, cloying, syrupy pink stuff. Today's rosés are beautiful. They can be bone dry. Not that they have to be bone dry to be good, because we shouldn't be doing any wine shaming with people who like sweet wine. Can we stop doing that? But rosé I love because it has all of the flavor of a red wine often.
It's a baby red, isn't it? I mean, a lot of people have no idea what rosé is. Some people think it's red and white poured together, which...
Yeah, that would be the cheap way. Yeah. But the good way is that you grow good red grapes, and it's called saignée, or bleeding, which doesn't sound good, but it's the runoff, the lighter pink juice from the first crush of the grapes. So it's got all that flavor, but none of the heavy tannin, oak, and alcohol.
Well, I have a quote for you, and it's from someone who makes bread for a living. And it's, I don't know who it's originally from, but it's everything in moderation.
Including moderation.
Yeah.
Including moderation.
Yes. Exactly.
So I think we should apply that to drinking. So, yeah, so you're like a spitter now, right? Like you used to drink a lot, and now you drink just a little?
Yeah, that's got to be tough. That has got to be really tough, because you can't not drink. That's your job. And I would also, while we're on the subject of tasting and spitting, I mean, do you get the full effect if you don't swallow? And by the way, if you're just joining us, we're talking about wine.
It's a good question. So there's five aspects to tasting wine: the sight, the smell, the feel, the body, and the finish. The finish is how long after you swallow does that impression last? 5 seconds is considered long, like
long
as in
finish.
All sensual pleasures, I think. Longer is better. But anyway, or 1 to 2 seconds is short, 3 seconds medium. I know that sounds really technical, but it's basically, is it still coming back to you like a good memory smell wise? Yeah, it is hard to evaluate the wines. You are absorbing through your soft tissue of your mouth anyway, but you know, if you really want to be exact, you would let a small trickle go down. But you know, when you're tasting 30 wines and so on, you really, I have to watch it in terms of, like, you know, how much consuming. yeah.
Barnyard, and I love Barnyard. Yeah.
Fruit salad.
So how much of it is BS? Because, you know, it's like dandelion this and dog poo this, and yeah. Yeah, like some of that stuff is like, yeah, you went to school and whatever. and some of it is, oh, yeah, no, I do taste the cherries, or I do. But I don't know. Who comes up with all that stuff? And is it all true? You can tell us. Top secret.
Okay. Just between us then. Lean in here. Okay. Yeah, the vocabulary of wine has evolved over time and needs to go a long way, because there's even embedded sexism with calling wines feminine and masculine and all the rest of it. But when it comes to this fruit salad stuff, I think that is, you know, wine succeeds where words fail, because wine is a sensory experience, and it's hard to trap that in words. So people are trying and struggling with all of these descriptors. But, you know, when I teach my online courses, I tell my students, just smell everything in your world around you. You know, when you cut open fruit or vegetables, that's when it's most pungent. Smell it. Develop a smell vocabulary. We live in a world that really, we've attuned our visual sense and our auditory sense, but we've lost our sniffer sense that we used to have to avoid dying. So smell everything. Smell the leather furniture. You know, just don't let anybody see you doing it. Smell the cinnamon on your toast. I'm practicing for my wine course. But you have to develop your own vocabulary. One course that I taught, this woman said, well, that smells like the Dallas airport. And everybody's puzzled. We're tasting Riesling. And then we put it together. Sometimes Riesling can taste or smell a bit like petrol, and it's a good thing. So she's smelling the jet fuel. Another one said, that smells like my son's gerbil cage.
We don't read that Chardonnay.
No.
No, you don't. But it's a whole lot more realistic.
Was it cedar?
Yes. The wood chips from the gerbil's cage. So yeah, you can be real about these descriptors. You don't have to get all fancy. And it's about developing your own smell vocabulary so that you heighten your own pleasure. I think what we appreciate or what we understand, we can appreciate a bit more. But it's okay if you don't want to. Just drink the wine. Don't think.
So just saying, you know, I sometimes say to my husband something as profound as, it smells like dog poo, but in a good way.
In a good way. Well, like manure. There's that sort of earthy smell. Yeah.
Manure. That's that barnyard thing. Yeah, absolutely. And it's a common characteristic or aroma in great Pinot Noir. Some people don't like it for obvious reasons. Sometimes it's caused by Brettanomyces, which is a bacterial infection, but some people actually like it. So it just depends on your taste.
I know it's weird. Olfactory. I love the smell of markers and gasoline. You know that.
Oh, me too.
Yeah.
Gasoline. Oh, I could just stay at a gas station all day. But I think it's because my father was a mechanic. I don't know.
But it's something weird. It's just like that attraction. I don't want to taste it. The smell is heady. Just as an aside, I remember. I think it was Diptyque or one of when the first really expensive candles were being introduced, and there was one that was called Versailles. And I smelt it and I said to the person, I think it was at Liberty in London. And I said, this smells a little bit like pee. And she said, well, it's funny that you should say that because
it's expensive pee.
Very expensive. But she said Versailles, they used to pee behind the tapestries. And so that smell, I know, well, they didn't have plumbing. And so that smell is sort of imbued in the wood in the, so if you go to Versailles, the distinctness from that. And so they put that in the candle and I'm like, wow, that's crazy. I didn't buy it.
You should be a sommelier. I mean, if you could smell the pee. And
no, I have to my sign. Well, that's the other thing too. You have to be in a certain, like I have, Wendy's been recovering from a cold for the last 6 years and,
6 weeks,
six weeks. And I, you know, it's allergy season right now. And that you've got to be especially sensitive to that because What if you lost your sense of taste and smell?
Well, during my terrible vintage, I did temporarily lose my sense of smell. And, you know, I was smelling, tasting, trying to a bunch of Shirazes. And I was like, oh, no, I don't smell anything. And it was temporary. But, you know, I did some research on it and talked to my doctor. But depression can cause a loss of smell because your brain size shrinks and the olfactory sense is very sensitive to that. And so I think it was probably related. It scared the heck out of me though, because, you know, my nose is my job.
We got to wrap up in a minute, but first I was struck by the similarities with, like, I met my dad when I was 18. You met yours when you were 16. That, you know, leaves a bit of a mark, which may become apparent in another 10 or 15 years. But you talk about, you devote your book to your mom. And I think my mom, she died 2 years ago, and I've been thinking a lot about her since. But it's all about being brave. And I think, Maureen, you and I, that's why we invite people on the podcast, is because they're trying to be brave.
No scaredy pants allowed.
Just women of ill repute. I love that.
Well, you know, that makes us stronger or funny anyway. But
absolutely. Just like witches. Like, you know, I think some of these words we just need to stop being afraid of and embrace. I mean, reclaim is an overused word. But for me, a witch is a wise woman who's walked through the flames and emerged on the other side knowing the measure of her powers.
Which is why
them.
Your book is called, I want to call it The Wine, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, but it's wine. I do. It's Wine Witch on Fire.
Yeah.
And are you going to be doing a book tour, or is it?
I am. Toronto, May 10th, Niagara, May 13th, Halifax, June 12th, Calgary sometime, Ottawa is May 31st. So, yeah.
That's where you're living now, right? You're in Ottawa.
This yeah. is where I am now. Yeah. So there's always books and bottles.
No, she's in the field.
She's in the field. She's outstanding in her field. Yeah.
I'm in the field. You know where to get me.
If you're watching us on YouTube, you'll see that that's a beautiful mural. Natalie McLean, you are you're just as we're going to say after you leave, wasn't she lovely? Thank you so much for being so open and helpful. And now we know what to pair with artichokes. That's the very least that we've learned this week.
I'm glad I could help you with that. That was my number one mission and reason for being here today. If anything, I can save them from their artichoke disasters. Seriously, I so appreciate both of you allowing me to chat with you and by extension, your audience. I have binge listened to all of your episodes and absolutely love your take on life and would love to have a glass of wine with you sometime.
Oh, that's almost certain to happen. And your newsletter, just to subscribe, just go to nataliemclean.com.
Yep. And sometimes people find that hard to spell. There's many ways to spell it. So I've also got the URL right now, winewitchonfire.com. For the book, I've got bonuses for the book. If people purchase it, I'll send them signed book plates. There's a free companion guide for book clubs, wine groups, and individual readers. So there's lots of stuff there at winewitch.com.
And Maureen and I will be by your house.
Leave your empties
on Sundays. Is that?
Yeah. Recycling day is on Fridays. So
good
book
to
your
know.
Tickets.
Natalie McLean, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you both. Cheers.
Cheers.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye. Well, she was lovely.
Well, some are lovelier than others.
They are.
You know, I get very nervous talking about the whole cancellation thing. That
I know you do. I know. But it's amazing how many times we've had guests on in the past who have, and that's kind of one of the reasons why we started this podcast, is there are people that come up against, and not just women, who come up against some serious roadblock in their careers or their personal lives and have to get around it. And that's, you know, we bring empathy to the table because that's happened to us. So,
yeah, there were so many other things I wanted to ask her, you know, like
tomatoes, hard to pair.
And asparagus. I mean, I didn't know that asparagus and artichokes are in the same family, but only one makes your pee funny. So we didn't get to talk about the really important things.
I think we covered it all off. You've been to wine tastings, haven't you, where you do spit into the thing? I've been to a few.
Yeah, no, my husband's really into wine, and he would spend his days spitting into glasses, and I'm like, look outside. I'm not really interested in the
to me, it's like, wow, this is good. My reaction is not to spit it. This is good. I'll have more.
Yeah, I don't know how many times we dropped the hint, like, we'd like to come over and collect the bottles.
Yeah, but... well, I think we'd absolutely be welcome to. Well, not collect. I think she'd like to have a glass of wine. I'd like to have a glass of wine with her. I'd like to have a glass of wine with a lot of our guests. So I guess that's a good thing, except for the ones that don't drink. I mean, I'd still, you know, they could have ginger ale.
Yeah, well, we didn't get into the study, so we'll have to have a conversation about. I don't think it was two sips a week. I mean, it was two glasses a week, or we'll kill
you,
right?
I know, but that's real. That was maybe the worst news of 2022.
Yeah, well, can't fix everything at once. Chin's up.
Bottoms up. Cheers.
Bye.
Women of Ill Repute was written and produced by Maureen Holloway and Wendy Mesley, with the help from the team at the Sound Off Media Company and producer Yet Belgraver.
Do, Did, Will, the Story of People podcast is now available on the Crier Media Network. The first 5 episodes are here and feature some incredible guests that fit into one or all 3 of those categories. Ready? Tara Sloan from the San Jose Sharks, Undercurrent podcast at NBC Sports. Marianne Iveson from Iveson Voice and the Let's Take This Outside podcast to talk about the world of outdoors as well as voiceover land. Ariana Hunsicker, future Canadian Paralympic swimmer, already winning tons of awards for this country. Scott McGregor from the Hot Wallet podcast to dumb down the world of crypto, Bitcoin, and NFTs so you don't have to. and Jackie Holowaty from Climate Pledge Arena in Seattle, Washington, the first net zero carbon certified arena on the planet. Wherever you get your pods, wherever you watch your pods, and on the Crier Media Network.